Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Michael Owen, born the 7th of November, 1980 in Pontypridd, mid Glamorgan, Wales. Michael is one of the great names from Welsh rugby's 21st century success story. He first came to prominence in his homeland as a member of the Wales side that reached the final of the Under-19 World Cup in 1999, making his debut in club rugby with Pontypridd the same year, where he went on to play a major role in the club's Welsh Cup success of 2002 and their run to the European Challenge Cup final the same season. After 5 seasons in the Pontypridd First 15, in 2003, he signed for Newport Gwent Dragons following the restructuring of Welsh club rugby, spending 5 seasons at Rodney Parade before ending his club career in the English Premiership with a spell at Saracens. However, it's his exploits playing for Wales which have afforded him the status of one of the nation's recent greats, where over 5 years he won 41 caps, captaining his country to Grand Slam glory in 2005 while he was a member of the squad which competed in the 2007 Rugby World Cup in France. During his career, he was also selected for the British and Irish Lions 2005 tour of New Zealand and also represented a World 15 and the Barbarians against South Africa. On TalkSport this evening, I'm joined on my sporting life by the Welsh rugby great, Michael Owen. As a young sporting Welsh prodigy growing up, what was it like to know that there was another young sporting Welsh-born prodigy called Michael Owen?
Yeah, I think a year older than me. And obviously being a Liverpool fan, I followed his progress fairly closely and sort of saw him coming through. Obviously, my parents couldn't have predicted that I'd play rugby and then getting asked all the time about the footballer Michael Owen.
Have you ever met him?
I've never met him, no. He's an amazing player. And I think it was one of the first press interviews I did. It was around the time of the Rugby World Cup and I got like tacked up royally. I'd said that I was a Liverpool fan and they pictured me with a Liverpool shirt on and a Liverpool scarf saying I'm the next Michael Owen and stuff like that. So when I started playing for Pontypridd then, there were some big characters in the side and I used to get loads of stick because I was pictured in the newspaper with a Liverpool scarf and a Liverpool thing. Like, so it was, made the guys aware of me and got me introduced to the team, certainly.
Tell us about your childhood.
I was a great childhood. So I got an older brother who's...
David?
Yeah, David was 5 or 6 years older than me. And he was a brilliant brother. I sort of really looked up to him and a massive influence on my rugby career and stuff. And I used to go on a Saturday. I'd go away with my dad to
watch. He was also a rugby player?
Yeah, my dad played for Pontypridd as well. Played over 100 games for Pontypridd and as did my uncle as well. So a real rugby family, if you like. And then we used to go and watch my brother play. So he played for a team called... it's a difficult pronunciation. Beathai, to say it correctly. And he'd been playing for their youth team, and they had a really good youth team, and used to go and watch them every Saturday. And they had a brilliant time. They had a really good side. They beat a really strong Pontypridd side in the local cup competition. Pontypridd side contained like some Martin Williams, Lee Jarvis, like future Welsh international. So it was a massive achievement for a small village club, and watching that was like a great dedication in terms of rugby for me.
The impression we get, and I don't want to be cliched, but the impression we get, particularly with people from South Wales, is that every town and village still has an unbelievable passion for the game of rugby, and every town and village has a team that turns out top players.
Yeah, it was massive. So the school that I went to, so Brinclernog, they were...
Thank you for saying
I got that one in for you, Danny.
There's even two more difficult schools before that, though, isn't there?
So, I'll tell you those. So Llancrun and Gwaen Celyn. So they were all difficult Welsh pronunciations.
I'm sure it's a beautiful language to speak. Yeah. It's just a tricky one to look at.
Definitely. But, so from my school, they were people the likes of... it was like five or six Welsh internationals. And they had, in the school reception... There's like photos of all the Welsh internationals all the way around. So I was in school with Gethin Jenkins, but like every day you go into school and you'd see all the pictures. So there was like Neil Jenkins, Paul John, Andrew Lamerton, and Greg Pross, and all these guys I ended up playing with. And it was absolutely amazing. But as a kid as well, I can remember looking up to. So I go and watch like Pontypridd senior team, and they were in a really tremendous period. Really, they were one of the best teams in Wales, and they were a force in Europe in the early days of the European Cup. And the people like Paul John, Neil Jenkins were there, and you'd see them all the time around the village. In fact, like Neil Jenkins, obviously meticulous like goal kicking practice, and we used to have games for our junior school, and we used to play on the local pitch. And I can remember one time we interrupted Neil Jenkins's kicking practice, and he stayed on the pitch for like the first like 20 minutes of the game, and he was at the other end of wherever the action was, and he was practicing his kicks while we were playing. But I think seeing those people was a massive inspiration. I think that was one of the things that was really special about Welsh rugby. You'd see these guys playing for Wales and the Six Nations, and they were like massive heroes, or Five Nations as it was then. And you'd see them driving around the village and whatever, and it was just really, really special. It felt like you could touch that success, if you like, and you were thinking, I can achieve that if they can.
Were you also a good footballer?
I was an okay footballer. I used to really, really enjoy it as a kid.
You're very tall, but you're a tall lad as well.
Yeah, I was always tall. I did give up rugby for a little bit to play football. I didn't give up completely, but I stopped playing for my rugby club and started playing football for about a season and a half. And I think it probably helped me in terms of vision and being able to see passes and stuff, which was obviously an attribute for me later on in my rugby career.
I mean, you're obviously good as a rugby player, as a young person, big strong boy and all the rest of it, because I notice here that you're a player of the year for Pontypridd schools.
That was amazing as well. I won that. For me, it was amazing. So winning that trophy, this was a big shield, and there were loads of names on it. And on that, there were people like Scott Gibbs, Neil Jenkins,
this
all these people.
Incredible.
So it's like you're seeing these, so that was like a district side, but you're seeing all these people, and it really does inspire you and make you want to aspire to try and achieve what they have. So yeah, it was pretty special being able to do that.
One of the things that's going to be laced through our story is your own family life, because it's affected your rugby at various times. Yeah. You met your wife Lucy. It's very heartwarming. It's a school romance, isn't it?
Yeah. So we were 15 and we met in French class. And we've been together.
Do
ever
you remember
since.
The exact class you were in? Yeah, or did she tell you to say that?
No, I do remember. Yeah, it was So it was good. So and we've been together, and she's been like unbelievable support to me and help. And obviously we had children quite young and stuff at 21. So my eldest daughter Ellie, and it's been the best thing that ever happened to us. And we had a fantastic time as a family, having some really special times through rugby and stuff like that. So yeah, it's been amazing.
I'm sure it's good. It's good to have your kids whenever you can, but to have them young is special, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It's obviously is pros and cons, and I think my wife and I and myself's plan is now is to retire about 45 and travel the world. So kids will be about 21 then. So it'll be they'll all be off and
also
doing
they can look after you from a much earlier age.
Definitely, that's the plan. Yeah. So,
now, just for the sake of not destroying the Welsh language, the beautiful Welsh language. I've got the names of the three schools that you went to during the time you were becoming a schoolboy international. Just for the listeners, just pronounce them for me, please.
Yeah, so it was Llancrun Infant School, Gwaen Celyn Junior School, and Brinclernog.
Michael, you're a brainy lad. You got 10 GCSEs at school, stayed on for your A-levels. Well done. Everyone should get as much education as they can. That's my opinion. A lot of clubs were looking to sign you then as a professional, as a player on the cusp of professional rugby. Saracens, Cardiff wanted to sign you, but you chose Pontypridd. Why was that?
Yeah, I think Pontypridd was obviously my local club, is where I'd grown up going to watch them. So I used to play on a Saturday morning. You play for Pontypridd schools, and they'd give you tickets, and you could go and watch Pontypridd in the afternoon. And at the time, Pontypridd were fantastic. That was my dream to play for them, I guess. And I had obviously the choice of going to Cardiff, and arguably Cardiff was more impressive. They sent us like really nice letters. They invited us down to sit in a box and watch a game and everything, so we went and did that. But then I guess it just felt right to try and play for Pontypridd.
It's a heart decision, isn't it?
In the heart, definitely. I think the other thing that was on my mind as well, I was thinking a little bit that I'd probably have more opportunities at Pontypridd because arguably more chance to come through the ranks there. But it was completely different. Pontypridd is probably more amateur. But I had an absolutely fantastic time. Some of the best days of my rugby career playing for Pontypridd Youth. I went there when I was like 16, and it was absolutely unbelievable. It was brilliant.
20 years on, rugby is a very different game. It's all on the surface. It appears very slick, very professional. What kind of game was it when you joined? What kind of club was Pontypridd?
It was amazing. We had a brilliant time playing for Pontypridd. So playing for Pontypridd Youth, I went there with some really big characters in the team. There was a guy called Gareth Turner who was like a big character, and he played one game for Pontypridd, and you speak to him now. And he played one game for the seniors as a substitute, played like 3 minutes, and it's still like the proudest achievement of his life, and he absolutely loved it, do you know what I mean? And and that was like what the guys do. So everyone who went to play for Pontypridd Youth had left maybe their village clubs to go there to have a crack at trying to get into the first team. So it was just fantastic. We had a brilliant atmosphere. And then when I was 18, I got called up to play for to train with the first team squad, and I think it was probably the most nervous I've ever been in my rugby career. There were some really big characters, some tough men as well. So there was the likes of Dale McIntosh, who was known as the Chief, who was an absolutely iconic figure at Pontypridd. Paul John and Neil Jenkins were there, and there was a guy called Steele Lewis, who was aptly named.
Steele
was his name. But he was a great guy and a great character. And I went to Pontypridd training. There was these big names with David James, Martin Williams, all these guys who were like internationals. And I went there, and I was so nervous going in. I didn't know whether they were going to like try and like beat you up
a rugby club. Anything could happen.
So you were quite frightened. Like, but then when you went, they were absolutely amazing. Like, and they were really warm and really nice and really welcoming. There was a guy called Neil Einan, who was a massive character, who'd be like making fun of you. He nicknamed me Peter Brown after the former Scottish number 8, and he used to commentate when we were playing touch. And they were just some great characters and great guys.
You had to sing a song for your initiation. Do you remember what you sang?
Yeah, The Gambler by Kenny Rogers. Yeah. So
your choice?
Yeah, it was my choice. Yeah, so when we used to go on holidays as a family, we'd come back and we had some bad cars. My father was a bit tight, so we bought like a Cortina and a thing, and the cassette player was in it. And the Gambler, we used to come back from holidays and be playing the Kenny Rogers thing, so we knew all the songs. So, but it was funny because I think it was just a sign of how ambitious I was as a rugby player in terms of I learned that song meticulously. I learned the words like over and over, so I knew them perfectly. And after a few weeks, it was brilliant. You felt like a rock star. You'd sing on the bus coming back from fixtures in England, and everyone would join in with the choruses and stuff. So it was great fun.
You continued to play representative rugby for districts and for Wales and all that. I noticed you played for a Welsh Schools 15 against Australia that got absolutely hammered. 56-10, it says here.
Yeah.
George Smith actually played for Australia. Yeah, he had a decent team.
He was the reason. He was amazing.
Do you remember what happened afterwards, what the coach said to you as a group of players?
Yeah, Wyn Evans was the coach from Llanelli, and the coaches were they were good guys, to be fair. But then after that game, he said none of you will have a professional career because of that game. He said we were like a disgrace and stuff, basically.
And yet four of the people in the team went on to captain Wales.
Yeah, so who was that? So it was
you,
Gethin, Matthew Rees,
and Dwayne Peel,
and myself.
So it's not Welsh bad.
I think there were a few other internationals. I think Andrew Lloyd might have played and a couple of others. So yeah,
tell you what kind of a young player George Smith must have been.
He was unbelievable, honestly, in that game. Like he was obviously renowned for like turning ball over.
Yeah.
And he's every time we took the ball and he'd steal it, and then he had this really quick fullback.
He's the model for the Pococks and stuff, and doing it
absolutely.
He was brilliant for Australia now.
I was a bit of a shock as well to lose like that. He didn't, but fair play, he deserved it.
You made your Pontypridd debut against Georgia in 1999 in a floodlit match. But that was that year, I guess you were still more involved with the Welsh under-19 team because there was a Welsh under-19 World Cup where Wales did fantastically well. Tell us about your memories of that.
Yeah, that was a really special tournament. So obviously you got all these guys, got all this ambition as young players and stuff. And then that was sort of the first time we sort of a little bit of the big time or high profile or whatever. It was unbelievable. So the first match we played in the Junior World Cup was against England.
It was in Wales, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was hosted in Wales. Yes, it was at the Knoll in Neath.
Yeah.
And I think we played them. And we won, I think, quite convincingly.
39-7.
Yeah, something like that. And we played really well. And it was like, say there was a crowd of like 3,000 watching us, which is like pretty amazing. And then we won that game. And obviously, I think it might have been on television as well. And we won, and it sort of really got like, people were like, oh, wow, this is a good side. And we played in Bridgend in the next game against Argentina. and we won that game as well. I think
29-5,
well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and during this time, we started to have like loads of like, so we stayed in hotels, about 12-day tournament. So that was special times as well. But then we had like sort of a real momentum going behind us after winning those two games. And then the third game, we played against South Africa.
A semi-final,
in the Brewery Field, yeah, in the semi-final. And it was, I think it was a sellout in Bridgend. And the atmosphere, the club grounds in Wales, well, they're all quite small and quite compact. And you
close
get like 10,000, 12,000.
Yeah.
And it was like an unbelievable atmosphere. And it was I think I was like 17 or 18 then. It was just absolutely incredible and really special. And we played and we drew 10 all with South Africa. And there was some strange rule. And I think they must have made it up because we were the home side. I remember when I played for Saracens, and Sharp Brits was playing for...
Wow.
It was playing for South Africa. And I remember him saying to me that he was still like, it was a ridiculous rule. I can't understand.
I've got it here in front of me. I got the newspaper report. The game ended 10-10. Wales qualified for the final as their kick had been a penalty while South Africa's was a drop goal.
Yeah, and I was, because I think it was like with the intention of rewarding fair play. Obviously,
with the intention of rewarding the home team, it looks like
to
me.
That's what it was. Yeah, definitely. But I didn't mind. It was,
you played New Zealand in the final.
And played New Zealand in the final, which was like a game. It was a bit like our Australia game. It was a bit of a chasing experience in terms of, like, they were just like, it was like men against boys. We were really tired after the three tough games. I think it was about 3 or 4 days later. We played against New Zealand. They had an unbelievable team. So Jerry Collins was playing for them, and Richie McCaw in the back row. And there were others as well. But then there was like Aaron Major and Ricky Flutie, I think, were there maybe 10 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
I think there might have been a couple of other future All Blacks as well.
I don't want to see nil in any rugby union score, but there's nil against Wales.
Yeah, they smashed us. I remember the first time running up trying to tackle Jerry Collins, and he had a big reputation because I think Wales schools had played against him in New Zealand a few years before, and he was like unbelievable and played in that game. And I remember me and the open side flanker, a guy called Tyrone Morris, going up to try and tackle him, and he just smashed us both back. We both came flying off, and he was an incredible player.
Yeah, and you're starting to make a progress there this time after the under-19s with Pontypridd. You got a new contract for the initially it was going to be for the glorious sum of £3,000, not a week.
Yeah.
A year.
Yeah, it was quite funny. So it was we went in to get a contract. I was just glad to sign, so I just signed it. But then Kerry Sweeney, who was a bit cheekier than me, if you like, he went in and said, I can't live on £3,000 a year, I want more money. Mm-hmm. And he ended up getting it bumped up. I think he ended up getting some like £5,000 in a car. And I think for fairness, they said that my contract should go up as well. So I went up for £5,000 but didn't have a car.
You should have given Kerry half that money.
I should definitely give him a little bit, yeah.
At a club level, and we'll get onto your international career in the next session, let's just say that you're obviously not just a good player yourself, but the Pontypridd team you're in is really doing well, because by the turn of the century, they've got a very good team. 2001, 2002, you win the Welsh Cup and almost won the Parker Pen, which was the European trophy as well.
Yeah, the European, the second tier European, the Challenge Cup sort of thing. So, yeah, that was very similar parallels to what happened with Wales later on in terms of coming into like a team that... So Pontypridd had been a superb side within Welsh club rugby and
legendary,
European rugby.
Yeah.
And I think about 1999, I think a load of players left, so the likes of... So Neil Jenkins, who was a real talisman, he left, and Martin Williams went and David James went. So they were left with like maybe an aging team that had sort of some of the major players taken out of it. So you're struggling a little bit. But then a group of youngsters came in. So it was like myself, Kerry Sweeney, Gethin Jenkins, Matthew Rees, sort of Robert Sadoli. They signed a guy called John Bryant, who was a great player. So they signed a group of players, and we had like a couple of seasons where we did okay, just ticking along, and we'd got experience. But at the start of that season, 2001-2, we were really struggling, and Richie Collins was the coach. And then they appointed a new director of rugby called Clive Jones, who was... phenomenal in terms of what he
Jones
did.
The rugby.
Yeah, in terms of what he did at Pontypridd, he did a great job. And then he brought in Lynn Howells as a coach, who was really influential on us as players.
You mentioned a whole group of them, but actually we've done the homework for you. Of the people who came into that side, 10 of you would go on to win Welsh caps. I mean, so that's an incredible influx of talent.
Yeah, it was really incredible. And I think the thing, I remember Dale McIntosh saying, in that run to the Parker Pen final, we played like Saracens in the quarterfinal, who had like a star-studded team. And I think he got asked the question, how are you going to cope against a team full of superstars? And his response was, we've also got a team of superstars. It's just no one realises it yet, which was a great response and proved to be fairly prophetic. So it was... And that was the sort of attitude we had. I think the people that were there, the older players, so the likes of Paul John, Dale McIntosh, who were hugely influential in terms of setting the tone and what it was going to be like. So they were just showing you that you could beat anyone if you were on your mind. If you just got stuck in and had a go, you could beat anyone, and that was the attitude we had. And sometimes we did, and sometimes we didn't. But they always tried to instill that you had that attitude, and you fought hard and worked hard, and try and see what you can achieve, and don't be overawed by people's reputations.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Michael, having made a name for yourself as one of the top emerging players in Welsh rugby, you made further progress being selected for the Welsh A side before going on to win your first international cap against South Africa in Bloemfontein. First of all, let's just say this was no ordinary cap. Do you still get an actual cap?
Yeah, still get a cap.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what kind of feeling is that for a young Welsh boy?
Yeah, it was amazing. I think, obviously, I've been dreaming about playing for Wales and training and working hard to try and get to that point for, I don't know, maybe 15, 16 years, something like that. So it was a big achievement. Like, I remember when I was awarded my first cap, Steve Hansen came up to me a couple of days before
the coach. In the
team, and he just came up and he said, "Are you expecting that to be a big deal?" And he just said, "You're playing on Saturday." And that was it. And he left the room. So that was his way of saying it.
You were the 1,000th player to represent Wales.
Yeah, which made it special. And so I got presented with a boot, a special, like, commemorative boot. And, like, obviously had more press coverage and stuff about it, so it made it a bit more of a big deal, maybe. And and that whole season, it was we were on the back of winning the Welsh Cup and playing in some really big matches for Pontypridd and playing some great rugby. And got picked for Wales, and it was a group of us. I think it was like 5 Pontypridd players went on the tour.
You lost 34-19 to South Africa in Bloemfontein.
Yeah.
Have you got any memories of the actual game?
Yeah, I think going into the game for me personally, it was I didn't want to let myself down. I was never phased about people always say, "Oh, what if you're a one cap wonder?" And I thought, "Oh, I don't really care. I just want to. If you get that one cap, I'd be really proud. And if that's all I have, then I'd be very privileged to have that." But I just wanted to make sure I didn't let myself down. And I played pretty well. I was happy with my performance. And on the reflection with Steve Hansen stuff, he said, "Hey, you did really well. Like, keep it going," or whatever. We had a young side. We tried to play some great rugby. We really moving the ball. Played some good stuff. And I think for Wales at that time, losing 34-19 to South Africa, we were right in the game until maybe the last 20, I think.
It wasn't the worst result you were having
at
that
time. It wasn't the worst result. And I think people were sort of could see a little bit. I felt quite optimistic about the way we performed. So they were positives to take out. But the tour itself was an amazing experience.
Yeah, and the next game that you also played in the second game, it was 19-8. These are, you know, things are picking up. And of course, it's one of the themes of this programme. We'll see how, you might say because of you, but at the time that you came into the Welsh team, they were doing terribly. And gradually, we'll hear the story of how they eventually win, a Grand Slam in the Six Nations. Also, as I said, threaded in throughout this is your family life, because you're one of those people who's had their kids young. You're still a very young man now, looking across the table at you. Your first child, Ellie, came along. It was a difficult birth. I think she was overdue and all the rest of it. But it also coincided with Pontypridd and a training camp. It wasn't quite as joyous for you as I think as it might have been.
No, it was a bit... Ellie being born was incredible, obviously, and everything. It was a very difficult time. My wife was had a very long labour, and she had to be induced. And also, it wasn't a very good time, and Ellie had some difficulties and stuff for the first sort of 10 days, and they weren't sure how things were going to go. And at the time there was a camp with Pontypridd, and it was just badly managed by the management and stuff, and me being a young man, I probably didn't deal with it. I wasn't as strong maybe as I should have been. And she said, look, I'm not going away, I'm staying here and doing that. And then while I was away, my daughter had a fit, and then it was just very worrying, and she had to go into special baby care and stuff. So it was just obviously I wish I'd been stronger at the time and said, look, I'm not going on the camp. But you're obviously worried about your future and worried about your contract situation and things like that. So it was just, I just felt it was like badly managed, and sort of it felt a bit disappointing to be treated like that when you've worked really hard and been part of a good team. I wish I'd just gone and done that. That was the way I should have been. But it all worked out.
Did it affect your relationship with Pontypridd?
Yeah, not with my feeling for the club or anything, but certainly in terms of with the coaches and the people that were sort of involved in that decision. Yeah, it did affect how I felt about the end, probably influenced me, was part of the reason why I went to the Dragons at the end of that season as well, yeah.
Which we'll come on to a little later in my sporting life. Then we get to the autumn. You're now in the Welsh team.
Yeah.
And we get to the Autumn Internationals of 2002. And an incident that gets described as not the Vale of Glamorgan, but the Jail of Glamorgan.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it was made more of it in the press than it was. Tell us about that. This is again Steve Hansen. He wanted all the players to stay in a hotel. But there was a great deal of, how can I put it, escape bids and leakage.
Yeah, I think obviously it's when I think Steve Hansen came in, he was trying to develop a culture, and he did it in South Africa, and he was a real stickler. I remember in South Africa, we'd do an ice bath and stuff, and it was sort of, they'd only just sort of come in maybe for a year or two. We're doing that, and Gethin Jenkins didn't do his ice bath, and then Steve Hansen came on the bus and said, you didn't do your ice bath, and he admitted it, and then he made him go back. And I think it was him and Martin Madden that had to go back and do 3 minutes in the ice bath because they tried to cheat. So you were saying they cheated the teams, so you're trying to create the culture and stuff. So I think for me, it was. I think for David James, obviously got caught out and stuff with that, but it was a bit of a ridiculous situation because most people lived 10, 15 minutes away.
Well, you were literally local.
Yeah,
to the
so
hotel,
I was 5 minutes from the hotel, so it was ridiculous. So I can remember you. In the night, I wanted to go home and see my wife and see my daughter and stuff.
Of course.
So you'd go home and you'd be sneaking back just terrified that you were going to get caught and get chucked out of the Welsh team. And David James was obviously unfortunate. And then Steve Hansen, I don't know, he's probably a bit of a, maybe he didn't fancy David James, so he made a statement by dropping him and stuff. But
I mean, Steve Hansen's a clever man because David James said that he'd only gone to the car to get his Walkman.
Yeah,
and Hansen went and felt the exhaust pipe.
A former police officer, yeah.
Oh,
but,
is that it?
Yeah, that's
okay.
What he was, yeah. So I think that's how he managed
too
to
investigate. Too smart for the average rugby player then.
Definitely, yeah. But I think it was obviously unfortunate as well because David James was a great player and it sort of maybe soured his international career a bit, and it was probably a little bit unfair. And I think, thinking back as well, when we had a team meeting and stuff, I think in the team meeting we had to announce that David James wasn't in the squad, I think there was a player missing who was at home that time because it was an unscheduled meeting. So I think there might have been a player missing in the meeting at the time when they were announcing because he'd gone home because people obviously felt that's what they wanted to do. So.
And I might just finish this section. You'll want to get through this as quickly as possible. The 2003 Six Nations Championship, Wales lost their opening game in Rome to Italy. By 32 points to 20. You were dropped after that game.
Yeah.
They went on to lose every one of the games for their first and presumably only ever Six Nations whitewash. Obviously, if you'd played, this wouldn't have happened. But this is terrible stuff.
Yeah, no, I think I played against Italy and didn't play very well. We were quite poorly prepared. I can remember at the time the players feeling like Steve Hansen was trying to do stuff with the line-out and stuff. And it was very, very different. And we didn't have a very good line-out. And obviously, to beat Italy, you had to be able to operate there. So I think everyone was a bit what's he doing, Steve Hansen? You couldn't see what he was trying to achieve. And yeah, it was a really, really horrible defeat. You lose like that. I lose to Italy. I think it might have been the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the first time in the Six Nations Wales had lost to Italy. So you feel really embarrassed and gutted. in that game as well, you could see glimpses. I'd love to see that game again. I think we scored like maybe two like unbelievable tries, like length of the field, like multiple phases, with some great passing, which would have been, if you just shown the try and compared it to a try we scored in the Six Nations, it would have been, you could have seen the parallels between the two. But yeah, it was a horrible moment. I got dropped after that game, and then just had to work really hard to try and fight my way back into the squad.
We need to continue to talk about the down before we get to the up. I mean, we're going to talk about a terrible run for the Welsh team before that, but also the club rugby in Wales in 2002-2003, very different from the other Celtic nations. Ireland had the four provinces, Scotland had three franchises, and Wales still had the old club system. Now, I'm old enough to remember when they used to be on grandstand, Michael, they used to read out all the rugby results from Wales, and these places I would never have heard of, Aberavon, you know, play, and indeed Pontypridd used to come on and they'd be playing these rugby matches. They reorganised it, so that and a lot of these great clubs disappeared from our sight. How did that feel? How did it go?
Yeah, it was horrible. And I think at Pontypridd as well, we'd sort of built up to become like a pretty strong team with a lot of good young players, and it felt like it was we were building something for the future to become even better and hopefully like start to become a bit of a force in Europe. So yeah, it was a massive change, and really disappointing. Obviously, growing up wanting to play for Pontypridd, and then that sort of lost. And I think, to be fair, the guy, so David Moffat was sort of the instigator of doing that. And I think they'd been spoken about in Welsh rugby for a long time, and they just sort of, by doing that, they'd sort of diminished what Welsh club rugby was about as well in some ways.
I should just let people know what actually happened. Was that Swansea and Neath became the Ospreys. Newport and Ebervale merged to become what's now the Newport Gwent Dragons. Yeah. Pontypridd merged with Bridgend to become the Celtic Warriors. And Cardiff remained as a standalone club, as did Llanelli. Yeah. But I thought perhaps then that it meant that perhaps the club you grew up at, Pontypridd, had disappeared. But the village still has, you're telling me, a very thriving rugby club.
Yeah, Pontypridd is a town, so a town surrounded by villages and stuff. But then, so they've got a great rugby club now. They're really successful. There's a Welsh Premiership, and they still have a Welsh Cup for the clubs. Pontypridd have won the double like a few times, and they've won countless league titles. And they're doing really well, and they've restructured the club, and they're running it in a really, really impressive fashion. And they get some big crowds for the big games, so they still get like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 for the big games. So yeah, so it's going pretty well.
You signed for the Dragons. Did all the Pontypridd players have to become Dragons, or did you get a choice? How did it work?
It was a really unbelievable process, really, when you look at it. So the guys got lined up outside the office of the coach, and so Lynn Howells, and I think it was Clive Jones as well, and they'd go in and they'd be told, yeah, we're going to keep you on. No, we're not going to keep you on. It was like that, and people would have had like existing contracts. There was a guy called Geraint Lewis, who was from the same area as me, played for Wales, really talented footballer, really good player, and he was like a surprise admission. They sort of said, right, we don't want to keep you anymore. And again, I had to go and find a contract that like relatively short notice. It was quite a tough process, I think, for a lot of people. And then I had a chance to got offered a contract by the Celtic Warriors. Little bit of talk with Cardiff and stuff. And then Mike Reddick came in for me going to the newly formed Gwent Dragons. And he sort of, the reason I went there in the end, I suppose, was because a few times during the season for Pontypridd, I got sort of like left out to the side and stuff, and I felt like I wanted to go somewhere where I'd be like 100% trusted and backed, and that's where Mike Reddick offered me sort of going to the Dragons, and I played under him for Wales A, and enjoyed it. So, and as it turned out, it was a great move, because obviously he became the Welsh coach and was obviously continued to back me. I think it was one of those things. So when I went to play for Wales A, which felt like it was a long time coming at the time, and I was really chuffed when I played for them. He was the coach, and for the first game against Ireland, he didn't pick me because he picked someone else and said to me the reason was because that guy had performed for me previously. So he felt like he wanted to give him a chance, another opportunity, which is fair enough. But then he didn't play well in the next game. He got dropped, and then they picked me. And we had a really good season with Wales A, won 4-4. And Mike, I think, because I played well, he sort of backed me and wanted me to be there. And then I went to the Dragons, and it was a great day for that first season with him as well. We had a really good season, and it was fantastic.
I mean, it's all faded into the mist of memory now. It's 10 years ago that all this, or more, that all this was happening. Has it worked out, do you think, the Welsh club system?
It's worked out in the sense that Wales as a national side have been more successful as they've ever been. They've obviously got a fantastic side now. The academy structure is working really well. So there's lots and lots of positives about it. But I think Welsh rugby has lost a little bit of something, maybe lost a little bit of its soul, because like I was saying, when I was growing up, you would have seen the people playing for your local town side. You could really feel like a tangible affiliation to it, if you like. And it was and you see those internationals go around the village or whatever, and then you go to Pontypridd, and it'd be like a real like meet. So it'd be like a real social thing as well. And obviously, you're trying to get all the people from the regions, from the villages surrounding Pontypridd, to go to the big town club, if you like. And that was what made it so special. So I think it's lost maybe a little bit of something. West Rugby's still strong, but I'm not sure if. I think in hindsight, what would have been better if the clubs fed more into the regions, if you like. So they were like the regions were the. With a genuine amalgamation of clubs, and it's a shame that we lost those like big derbies like Swansea Llanelli, Swansea Neath, Pontypridd, Cardiff, Newport, Cardiff. It was some really, really big, like ferocious derbies and stuff. And I think Welsh rugby has lost a little bit despite being really successful since the start of the regions.
Talking about the build up to the World Cup in 2003.
Yeah, so the World Cup in 2003, I think this was where we started to really build. So there was they had a new fitness coach, a guy called Andrew Hoare. Scott Johnston was involved, and Steve Hansen. So those three were sort of coming together, and they were a really good team together. And Clive Griffiths as well was a really good defence coach. They were all sort of working there as a group. And then that pre-season, we had a great pre-season, trained really hard, really, really progressing, striving for that World Cup, and feeling like we could go there and have a good campaign. And unfortunately for me, I got injured. I got injured a little bit before, and then I had to pull out about 2 days before we left or something, which was a pretty devastating blow. But
I'm just and not to put too fine a point on it, then we'll stop talking about the run of defeats now. England beat Wales in the run-up to that 2003 World Cup. That was the 11th defeat on the spin for Wales. It's just not quite, it's just not a figure that makes any sense. And equally, it was England's 14th win on the trot, and of course they went on to be the world champions. After that, in 2004, you were fit again. I mean, you're starting to have some injuries here, Michael, but it's part of the story as well, isn't it? The fact that you're a big, long frame of a man, aren't you? And for how tall are you? 6'5", 6'6"?
6'5", yeah.
You're not massively bulked out. You're not 6'5" across the shoulders, are you?
Not anymore, no. But no. I was still about 17 and a half, 18 stone. So it's
just a cult. What do you remember about 2004 Six Nations? Because we're going to hear in the second half of the show about that amazing season. Well, not only did Wales win the Grand Slam in 2005 with yourself as captain, but that they played such amazing rugby. Was there signs of it happening in 2004?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in 2004, Wales had come back from the World Cup where they'd had a decent showing in the World Cup. So they got through the group and then lost to England in the quarterfinals, and really a challenge. Well, was obviously a tremendous English side. And then starting the 2004 Six Nations, I'd stayed home. I managed to get myself really fit at the Dragons and was playing some good rugby there as well, and enjoying my time at the Dragons. We had a good side there as well, and we were at the top of the sort of the Celtic League, so I was going really well. And at the start of the Six Nations, I got picked in the squad, and I think I was on the bench for the. I think we played Scotland first. Yeah. And I was on the bench for that.
Then you lost to Ireland.
Yeah, and I was on the bench for those two games and did okay. And then in between that, there was a game against Ulster, I think, for Pontypridd, for the Dragons.
Yep.
And I had a really good game in there. I think I had man of the match and maybe scored a try or something like that. And then I got picked for the following game against France.
Which good judges who I've spoken to in the run-up to preparing for this programme tell me was your best ever performance for Wales.
Yeah, I had an amazing game that day in some ways, because it just everything was going for me. So I was calling the line-outs and playing second row, which obviously I was probably more of a number eight, but I played second row in that game. I was calling line-outs. Every time I called the ball to me, I won it. I was winning a clean line-out ball. I caught the kickoffs. I was running a line. I'd just go through, and I was offloading. So I had a really, really good game. It's just for me, I think it was unfortunate that we didn't manage to win the game. But I can remember playing in that game and really feeling, probably for the first time, feeling really at home in international rugby and feeling like I could really make a difference. I think it was probably a little bit to do with my conditioning. I was really fit at the time, and just the style of rugby that we were playing as well. So under Steve Hansen and Scott Johnson and Andrew Hoare, well, you see him as a triumvirate, if you like. But the way we were training, we just trained unbelievable. They just brought the best out of my skills.
At the end of that tournament, Steve Hansen was replaced by your mentor, if that's the right word, Mike Ruddock. And we'll hear more about that in just a few moments' time here on My Sporting Life as we head into one of the great stories from Welsh and European rugby. What do you remember about the lead-up to the Six Nations in 2005?
Yeah, I think it probably started, so Mike took us on tour to Argentina and South Africa, which was an okay tour. We beat Argentina, lost one and won one, and then lost to South Africa. But then we came back for the Autumn Internationals, and we had a great Autumn International series. I think we lost to South Africa by 2 points and played okay. And then we played New Zealand, and that was I was talking earlier about the Millennium Stadium being half empty, and that game against New Zealand was unbelievable. New Zealand were a brilliant team, and we performed at such a high level. And we lost 26-25, a game we probably should have won. They had Joe Rockathoko was playing for them on the wing, scored two unbelievable tries, which turned the game for them. But it was a great game for us to stand up there with the best team in world rugby. Was amazing, and that sort of sent us into the Six Nations.
You mentioned that you've been away on the tour in Argentina and South Africa. You were injured for South Africa, but you did get to meet Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, we got to meet Nelson Mandela, which was so he got introduced us for the game. So I just shook his hand, and there was a photo which I've got somewhere of me shaking his hand. It was obviously a pretty incredible moment. He's a like tremendous statesman and stuff, and it was pretty incredible to get to meet him and shake his hand.
After returning from South Africa, you got married to Lucy, who we heard about in the French lesson a little earlier on. Yeah,
yeah, we had a really nice wedding. We got married in Miskin Manor, which is just off the M4. Like you say, you would have passed a few times on your way to get a ferry. But it was a beautiful hotel, and we had a great day. Lots of friends and family, and I sang The Gambler again that night as well. So it was.
Do you know any other songs, Michael?
That's the only song I know. So it's, if you heard the tune, you've just got to say it as well. So you haven't got to do too much singing. So it suits my voice. But we had a great day, and it was. And my daughter was there as a flower girl and stuff as well, which was quite funny and quite nice. So yeah, it's good.
Good. So we get to the 2005 Six Nations. How did you get to be? Well, we'll talk first about the game you played against England, because I guess this is where people start to take this team very seriously. And for a start, for a nation which prides itself on two things: one, playing rugby; two, beating England. It's been 6 years since you managed to get the better of England.
Yeah, and I think what happened with the Welsh team as well, we'd sort of been getting closer. So in the World Cup, they challenged New Zealand and they challenged England, so starting to get to the top table. And then in the Six Nations in 2004, we were close to England, close to France, and they were the top teams at the time. Then the autumn, close to New Zealand, close to South Africa, so really starting to get somewhere. But then we sort of finally cracked it, if you like, against England, winning that game, a really tight game, but winning 11-9. And I think one of the things that was really pleasing in that game as well, towards the end of the game, when we had to see out the game, we didn't panic, we didn't like try and kick the ball away, we just kept playing our rugby. We had good phases of play and just kept the ball and looked really composed.
I mean, just to remind people about that game, you trailed 8-9, it's a very tight, very, very stern game of rugby after Charlie Hodgson kicked a penalty for England with 5 minutes left. And then Gavin Henson scored with a penalty from fully 50 yards away. It was a brilliant kick. Gavin is a funny old phenomenon now, isn't he? Because here he is, a very important, he's a brilliant player, but he's become kind of labelled now as a kind of showbiz clown, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think people sometimes forget what he has achieved in the game as well. I think when you look at what he's done, he was like World Player of the Year, I think, as a World Young Player of the Year as well, as an under 20 or whatever, which is an incredible achievement. He won two Grand Slams, I think, for Wales. He won the Celtic League with the Ospreys, and he's played in France, England, and in Wales as well. So he's even though he's done all those other things, and maybe that has detracted from his rugby somewhat, he's still had a tremendous career and been a real top player. So I think when people say he hasn't fulfilled his potential, I think he hasn't had a bad time, and obviously doing some of the stuff he's done, he's had a pretty good life. So
do you think if he hadn't been Mr. Charlotte Church, people would take him more seriously?
I don't know. I think as a rugby player, he was just as a personality, I think his personality was maybe a little bit like he was either like incredibly meticulous and like the best professional, or he just go off the wall and be gone. So he's just I think that's just his personality, and he's obviously, in fairness to him, he's done what he wanted to do, and he's probably had a great time doing it as well. So he's a funny one, Gavin. He can be great at really, really nice guy at times, and then he's quite quiet and keeps to himself, and I think he's got his own circle of friends. So he was always like quite the, like my experience of him was generally he was quite quiet and professional, and he had a few moments where you go a little bit off the wall, but pretty, it's all right.
Well, that amazing kick from the halfway line, Bob, inside the half, gives Wales that victory over England. It's easy, Michael, to pick out one game and say that was a big moment. Was that a very significant win, do you think?
It was a massive win, yeah. It was huge because, like I say, we'd beaten a big team all of a sudden, and that just gives you that little bit more belief, a little bit more confidence in what you're capable of as a team. And it was a hard fought win, and we had to do lots of good things. Some parts of it were a grind, some parts of it were great. Then it was brilliant. I can remember after the match walking out of the stadium, it was me and Lucy, and we were on our own. I was speaking to Gareth Edwards after the game. It was like sort of first time I'd really like spoken to him, and he was saying that's a really significant win, great together, that sort of monkey off your back, if you like, and hopefully you can go on and be successful. And it was great to be talking to people like that and to get a little bit of advice. So yeah, it was pretty special.
You then beat Italy comfortably at the Flamini by 38-8, 6 tries for Wales. Yep. So obviously the flowing rugby of which you were a part, yep. I mean, a back who could make a pass, who could see a break, was obviously coming. And then, of course, one of the most traditionally difficult fixtures in any team's calendar, you had to go to the Stade de France. Tell us about the game against France.
Yeah, that was a big crunch game, if you like. I think if we, obviously, if we could win that game, that was going to like set us up to the midpoint of the championship, set us up to go on and be successful. But I can remember for myself just being in that game, I felt I was really focused. And in the first half, we were really struggling in the scrum. So as a number eight, I had to like pick up every scrum, just to try and keep the ball. I managed and did that quite well. I remember saying to Adam Jones, said, "Ad, what's happening with the scrum? Can we sort that out?" And he told me in no uncertain terms, "I'm getting flipping stuff. It's hard work." Like, do you know what I mean? So he put me in my place. He's normally really quiet, Adam. So but I was just picking the ball up and keeping it. But at halftime, I went in feeling confident. And I think it's sometimes an individual thing. I felt like it was okay. I didn't feel like we were really struggling in the game, even though we clearly were on the scoreboard. As a player, I felt that we were in the game if we could just do things a little bit more correctly.
You went in at half time, as you say, 15-6 down, so still in the game, but behind, yeah, against a good French team in France. And then, of course, Gareth Thomas hurt his thumb, yeah, broke it. And
that sounds like it's a very small injury when you say it, put it like
no,
that.
No,
it was
he
quite
broke
serious.
His thumb. Yeah. I think if you're playing rugby, I mean, I've met Gareth Thomas, yeah, believe me, a sore thumb would not stop him playing,
definitely,
would it?
He's a pretty tough player.
Yeah, absolutely. And you got the captain's armband.
Yeah, so I've been vice captain and stuff. So I think if you say that, it's like, it's obviously you got a great magnitude or whatever being captain of your country. But in the way it happened for me, it was sort of just like, it was just the next thing. And that's what happens a lot of the time. You don't get a chance to think about this. So, and like I say, I was feeling confident at halftime, even though we hadn't played well as a team. For myself, I felt confident. I felt in the game, and I felt that we could do all right if we just kept the ball. And I guess like that confidence I had, like you just try and reflect that to other people, but everyone stepped up, and it was a great second half.
During which Martin Williams scored twice from the back row for Wales, and with the score on 18-18, Simon Jones kicked a penalty and a late drop goal as Wales held off the intense late French pressure to win. And when you've beaten England and France, you must know that there's a very, I mean, obviously the Italy game as well, but when you've beaten England and France, you must have thought, wow, not only are we in a chance with the championship here, but the first Welsh Grand Slam for a quarter of a century. Yeah. Since those legendary, I mean, they were ridiculously legendary teams.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think when you're in the bubble of being in a professional team, I think sometimes that you don't get caught up in that. I think because the Six Nations is so short, it doesn't hit you, the speculation and stuff. So like, I know like when you talk about Premier League campaigns in football and stuff, and because it's such a long season, you've got so long to think about it. I think with us in the Six Nations, it didn't, although clearly you're in a good position, I can never really remember thinking, oh my God, we can win the Six Nations. I just sort of, you're just moving on to the next thing. So you go back from France or whatever, then you're recovering, you're getting prepared for the next game. So it just sort of keeps moving, and the atmosphere in the camp was brilliant. It was really relaxed. We used to play football before training and stuff, and it was just and loads of touch rugby. It was just really relaxed, and we were just having a great time and playing good rugby.
Okay, the good rugby continues. We're now counting down the games. Yeah. With the penultimate game of the tournament for you Wales, you went to Murrayfield and ran up a record win against Scotland. But you as captain.
Yeah. So I was captain. So I thought that week then you're obviously a bit more focused. But being captain at that time as well, it's really easy because we're riding the crest of a wave. Everyone just asks you nice questions. Everyone's just really pleased to speak to you. Everyone's just like, hey, brilliant. Everything's great. So it wasn't
Did you like doing all those press conferences?
It, Well, you do them anyway as a player. Obviously, you get a little bit more focused as a captain. But when everything's going great, it's brilliant. It's the best job in the world because everyone thinks you go, why? How are you doing so well? And all that. And also, like, it's just a nice feel to it. Obviously, I experienced a slightly different side to it, like a couple of years late or a year or so later as captain. But during that Six Nations, it was amazing. We went to Scotland. We were really confident. Scotland had a bit of a difficult time, I think, with their coach. And yeah, we just we started 100 miles an hour and just managed to see them off fairly easily.
Michael, we left the last section with one game to go in the 2005 Six Nations. Wales had won their first five. Then the last three games have been away from home. Then you return to the Principality for the game against Ireland. Wales on the cusp of their first Grand Slam for 27 years. Ireland still with a chance of the Triple Crown. Huge game.
Yeah, absolutely huge. It was a massive build-up to the game. And I think just during the week, it was a bit like winning my first cap. I just felt like just the magnitude of the game. Trying obviously not to get caught up in that, but just trying to think, just try and perform, just don't let ourselves down, make sure we perform on the day, and then if we win, we win, and if we don't, we don't. You just got to be able to take it. But I felt that if we just went in there and just tried to play as well as we could, then we'd be able to get it.
I think for every rugby player of your generation, there's that image of the England players going up to Scotland for the Grand Slam match and David Soul's team walking out and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
It's one thing being the best team. You have to do it on the pitch, don't you?
Yeah, on our last day as well, yeah. And I think for us as well as the West team, in some senses, we would have probably come from nowhere. I don't think there would have been many people predicting that we'd win the Six Nations. I think probably Ireland, France and England all ranked ahead of us and stuff, but it was brilliant as well. We just, the way the week was managed was great. I think we played on a Sunday in Scotland and then it was a Saturday in Cardiff, so we just sort of that week it was just quite low key. We just, like I say, just having loads of fun, playing a bit of football, playing a bit of touch rugby, making sure we'd done our prep right, and people like Robert Sadoli really instrumental in making sure our lineup was like spot on, and just going in and performing and giving everything we got. And Ireland was always going to be a tough match for us because they'd sort of been one of those teams where we just hadn't performed against them. We just sort of, they just kept beating us, and over, say, that 3-year period, 4-year period before, where that team had sort of been together, they just kept beating us, giving us a couple of big defeats in Dublin and stuff. So it was a tough game.
But obviously, I follow Irish rugby as closely as I can, and I remember the game very, very clearly, the first half, and particularly that Tom Shanklin, the Welsh player, who, you know, let's be fair, Tom's not a superstar.
Yeah.
He had absolutely murdered Brian O'Driscoll. Yeah, that set the tone for the game.
Yeah, definitely. Brian O'Driscoll was obviously like one of the all-time greats and stuff. Yeah,
absolutely.
And then Tom Shanklin was amazing that day. Really, like, sort of just closed him down, put him under a lot of pressure. Brian O'Driscoll making uncharacteristic mistakes and getting frustrated. And yeah, just a tremendous performance from Tom Shanklin. But I think it was one of those everyone just did a little bit, and so you make sure when they line up ball, make sure you make your tackles, like work with the ball, and we played some good rugby as well. And I think the try that we scored to seal the game, if you like, was the epitome of that sort of play.
When you hear that, what does it make you feel like?
Yeah, it's amazing. I think I hadn't seen it and I watched it, but it was like on ESPN Classic or something, and I think they saw the game and it just made the hairs in the back of my neck stand up. And because I think when you're playing sport, you sort of, you don't comprehend what it means and stuff, and you sort of lose that sense of being a fan a little bit. And I think there were a few things that happened around that game that really made you sort of realise that at the time, but then reflecting back and that makes it really special. It was sort of driving in and Millennium Stadium in Cardiff is right in the middle of town.
On the river, beautiful
thing.
Yeah,
so it's amazing, yeah. But you drive in on the bus and you drive in sort of through the main streets of Cardiff to get to the entrance, and that day it was unbelievable. It was just like so all the outside Cardiff Castle, it was a beautiful day as well. It was packed out all the way through the streets. Everyone was stopping and clapping the bus, and you just, as you were driving the bus, just thinking, oh, and you just like excited to play and excited to be there. And then afterwards, obviously the celebrations and stuff in the stadium. And then I think they showed us a video, so the guy who used to do the video analysis, Alan Carter, and they had clips of people, the troops in Basra. And I think there was a video of them, and they were all watching the game, and they were all going absolutely ballistic because we won the Six Nations. And I think, like, you don't realise that that's the effect that the actions of us as a collective, as a team, has that effect on people and can bring such joy to people. And that's what is really special. And to be able to see that happening is makes you like pretty emotional and feel pretty proud of your efforts.
You're right to feel emotional and proud. There was one moment you still had one captain's duty to do. To go and lift the trophy and the Six Nations trophy. Obviously, the world, the spotlight of the entire world was on you, Michael Owen. Why didn't you take off that stupid scrum hat?
Yeah, it's a shocker. What happened? So I never wore a scrum cap, but I had a cauliflower ear, So my ear was like flaring up all the time. So I started wearing one. And I'd never worn before. So at the end, but after every single match in the Six Nations, I'd done the same thing. So all I did at the end of the match, rather than like taking it off and putting it in my shorts or something, I would just like undo the strap.
Yeah.
So it's like dangling down. So on that day, that's what I did. And I think that just sort of shows as well how much like you're not conscious of the, or I wasn't conscious of the public, the fact that millions of people all over the world are watching me with a stupid scrum cap on my head. So yeah, you just weren't conscious of it. You just focused on the rugby and enjoying that. And then obviously afterwards, you could sort of see that.
Were your parents in the stadium that night?
Yeah, my parents were there. My uncle went. And my uncle had been like, he'd had like some heart trouble and stuff and hadn't drunk for ages, but he took a drink that day and stuff. And it was a really nice moment actually. When we won the Six Nations, the wives and girlfriends area sort of is like directly above, like in the second tier stand. I can remember looking at Lucy and just feeling like it was a really nice moment to sort of share that together, and like she'd obviously helped me loads and stuff, so that was a nice sort of like nice moment. And also I think at the time I just felt, remember feeling like I did, obviously felt absolutely delighted, but it was more, you were like a relief as well. Do you know what I mean? Just thinking, oh, a satisfaction rather, not relief, satisfaction of what we'd achieved and where we'd come from as a group and all the hard work you put in the early morning sessions and all that stuff. And it was a real tremendous sort of thing as a team to go through.
So you're the captain of the most important Welsh rugby, or the most important Welsh sports team for a quarter of a century. As I say, it's a global sport now, and so everyone knows who you are, Michael Owen, and what you look like and all the rest of it. But you were brought down to earth the following day.
Yeah, I went to get fish and chips from the chip shop, and the woman said, oh, did you enjoy the game yesterday? I said, yeah, it was good. And she said, oh, where did you watch it, love? So, yeah, she didn't have a clue. She probably still doesn't, does she? So, but I was like, yeah, I was there.
Well, it was an amazing moment, and it's been a pleasure actually sharing that moment with you, watching you listen to the commentary. It was really, really, I mean, tears are in my eyes, never mind yours. Let's be joined now by somebody who had an important part to play in lots of your career. He coached you at club level, at junior international level, and of course was the manager of the Welsh team the day of that famous triumph. So good evening to Mike Ruddock. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Danny. How are you, Mike?
You good, thanks, Mike. Yourself?
Everything's good, mate. Everything's good.
Listen, Mike Ruddock in this case, talk to us about what kind of a player Michael Owen was and why he became so important to that great Welsh team.
Yeah, well, I remember seeing Michael first playing for Pontypridd as a real young man. I'd remembered his dad playing rugby.
Wow.
Believe it or not, many years ago. And I remember Michael then bursting onto the scene with Pontypridd as a fine young player, in amongst a number of other, you know, fine young players that Pontypridd were producing at that time. And I was lucky enough then to get the opportunity to sort of work with Michael a bit in the Wales A team. And Michael was playing for me at number 8. And then when rugby went regional in Wales, I spoke to my new chairman of the Newport Gwen Dragons. And I said, look, the first guy I'd like to get on my team sheet is Michael Owen. I think he's not only a fantastic rugby player, but he's got this amazing rugby brain for a forward. As an ex-forward myself, I was head down, backside up. You know, so I hadn't seen too many of these guys who could raise the head above the sort of melee and see where space was and have an ability to sort of know how to break down defences as a forward. So I managed to convince the Newport Gwent Dragons that we should sign Michael Owen, and we managed to do that. And he always impressed me, really, not just as a rugby player, but as a quietly spoken leader who sort of people wanted to follow, you know. So I was delighted we got him on board, and then delighted I got to work with him in the Welsh team.
Do you recognise yourself from that portrait, Michael?
That's very nice of Mike to say those things. Yeah, there's a little bit of truth, I think. Yeah, I hope.
Well, it was a downside, and that was his scrum cap. I think that was the only thing
that
let him down.
That was a bad decision, Mike. That was because of all the scrummaging practice you used to make us do.
On the other hand, his ears still look vaguely human, so I suppose there's some benefit to it. Mike, you mentioned there, and I hope it wasn't an insult to say that he was bright. He was very bright for a forward, but he also went on to captain Wales. There's many ways of doing that, but how did Mike Owen's personality make him a suitable captain?
Yeah, well, Michael was my original sort of vice captain, if you like, and Garth Thomas was the captain, and then Garth got injured in the first half out in France, and we were we were losing, I think, something like 15-6 at halftime. France were all over us, beating us in every department, really. And I remember turning to Clive Griffiths, our defence coach, and saying, Clive, you know, we'd be lucky to get out of this under 30 points the way things are going, you know. So we walked in at halftime, got the medical report that Gareth Thomas was injured. He'd broken his thumb. And Michael, of course, then, I asked him to sort of take the reins as the vice-captain to become captain. And again, what impressed me, there was no panic. Michael just sort of said, right, this is what we're going to do. Took charge. Boys got in behind him. And, you know, we got out there for the second half and the boys just played some fantastic rugby. And I think you've got to put a lot of that down to Michael's calmness in a very pressurised, you know, environment in a tough sort of moment. And that's when you need quality guys just to say, hey, I'm not fazed by this. If we do these two or three things really well now, we can get back in the game. And I think that was, you know, what sort of stood out for me with Michael. And then, of course, he led us then to, you know, to victory up in Scotland. And then, of course, at home, I think, against Ireland, again, where his leadership skills were to the fore. And, yeah, what a fantastic player he was.
Michael, there comes a moment following your brilliant 2005 triumph in the Six Nations that I think a lot of rugby players like as well. In fact, I've never spoken to a rugby union player who wasn't deeply, deeply affected by their experience with joining the British Lions, and you had that opportunity.
Yeah, it was amazing. So I got selected for the British Lions, which was obviously a great honour. And we were going to the toughest place in the world to tour, so going to New Zealand. Yeah, and we had a week get-together in Cardiff. We ended up playing Argentina. And I was lucky enough to be given the captaincy and stuff for that game at the Millennium Stadium. So that was a great honour. The game itself didn't go so well. We didn't play great, but we didn't have much preparation either going into the game. We sort of just did a little bit of line-out stuff, and fair play to Argentina, as always. They're always very combative, and they play with tremendous passion, and we struggled in the game, and I think it was a draw in the end.
I don't know how the tour went for you in New Zealand in terms of what your memories are enjoyable or not, but it was certainly complicated for you. You played in the opening game, or you played against the Maori, and then your daughter came along and you had to go back to Britain in the middle of the tour. It was a messy sort of start to the tour.
My daughter Olivia was born, yeah, and I went back to see her being born and everything, which was obviously a really special moment. It wasn't as a difficult moment for me and my family in terms of leaving and going back to the tour and stuff, so it's obviously a... You're torn and sort of on the tour as well. It's just a difficult situation.
How long were you in Wales for?
For about two or three days. So it wasn't very long at all. So
you had to fly the whole width of the world.
Yeah.
See your baby being born.
Yeah.
And then fly back again.
Yeah, and it was amazing. I was obviously in some ways didn't want to be in New Zealand. You wanted to be at home with your family, and I chose to do that. It was my choice, and I made that. So and it was just difficult. And in terms of the tour itself, going back to the rugby, it was just I didn't feel that it affected me adversely. I think I went, the Argentina game was a write-off. I don't think anyone did themselves any favour in that game. We didn't do very well. And I played against Taranaki in one of the early games, like second game of the tour, I think it was. And I had a great game as well. I played really well. I was on, my passing and vision and stuff was really good. I was involved in a couple of like great movements and plays and really enjoyed it, so I felt like I was playing well. I went back on the tour and we were playing Otago, and Ryan Jones had come on the tour and had a great game that night, but I came on in that game and was on for like 10 minutes and maybe I had like 5 touches of the ball, and I felt like I was playing well. The coaches obviously felt differently. Before that game, we played against the Maoris, tough game for all of us. I made at the end of the game, I think myself and Martin Williams, maybe I made a pass to Martin Williams. Martin Williams made a break, gave the ball back to me, and then I tried to do it was a really poor decision by me. Tried to do, which I was normally good at, would have been quite composed under pressure, and tried to do a ridiculous pass around my back, which was like a stupid thing to do, and it didn't come off.
But
I clearly didn't have the talent to do that. But it didn't go on. I didn't get any feedback from the coach, but I think that would have been like for Clive Woodward, in terms of his thing and all his mantras and stuff, and talking about thinking teacup or whatever, thinking correctly under pressure. So I probably didn't like endear myself there. So I didn't get, and then I was sort of on the outer for the rest of the tour. But I felt like I played well enough. The Auckland game at the end of the tour, I felt like I had a good game as well. And I obviously captained the side against Southland. I felt like I didn't feel like I was out of form playing out there. I could have done better, but as a team, we never really got going. We didn't. The tour itself was like complicated in terms of having the two squads, and it was a good idea, but I don't think it really worked. And the tour never really got going, and we certainly didn't get the best out of the considerable playing talent that was there. So that was a shame. But
whose door do you lay that at, Clive's?
I think, yeah, you've got to, haven't you? I think as a coach, I think he tried to do something very different from the 2001 tour in terms of he saw the problems over there and tried to do it. And you've got to admire him for trying to do it differently. But I just felt that he didn't get the nuts and bolts right in terms of the coaching, in terms of you need people like whoever the coach is going to be, you need to have that central figure who puts his heart and soul into that team and trying to shape it in his image or whatever. And that never really happened. There was never really anyone sort of in control of that. Of that tour, if you like, and in terms of the rugby side of it and how we were going to play, and that was what I think ultimately undid it. But I had a great time. The two met some fantastic people, and just like brilliant to meet people from all the different nations and get to know them a little bit, and had a wonderful experience.
Still friends with some of those players?
Yeah. So I've met up with a few of the people, obviously the Welsh guys and stuff, and it's just got lots of good contacts and lots of good people. And it's one of those things, you may not be like in touch with people all the time, but if you bump into someone, you sit down and have a chat, and it's a nice thing, and that camaraderie and common experience is something special.
We might gloss over the 2006 Six Nations because following the Grand Slam, and Wales were pretty terrible, I think, the following year.
That's the way we like to do it, go up and down and make it exciting for people.
Not helped perhaps by Gavin Henson's book, My Grand Slam Year.
I think like for Gavin, it's just one of those things, isn't it? I think a lot was made of that as well. It's probably overstated and loads of things happened. But that's the way it goes, isn't it?
And the World Cup comes around in 2007. I'm sorry I'm rattling through this, but there's plenty to get through, Michael. Yeah. Wales are in a group with Canada, who they beat, with Australia, who you lose to, and then you beat Japan. You know what I'm going to say next. Yeah. to get through the group, you've got to beat Fiji. Now, of course, we saw in the last World Cup recently that when Japan beats South Africa, that anything can happen.
Absolutely.
At these levels. The gap between, as other teams become professional, the gap is inevitably widening. But I do think that Welsh loss to Fiji, maybe one of the most famous defeats in world rugby history.
Fiji were fantastic and they deserved the win. I think for me going to that World Cup, that was a big achievement for me getting to the World Cup. I'd sort of, after 2005, I got dropped in 2006 when Gareth Jenkins came in, and I had to work really hard to try and get back. I didn't get in the Six Nations, and I went to Australia and had a great time and got back in the squad. So I was really proud of that achievement. I felt like I'd improved as a player. And I went to the World Cup and I was on the bench. I think I came on for Fiji. It was my last international for Wales, and I had about 15 minutes. But in terms of that game, it was just... I think Fiji just played a great match, and we played some great rugby as well.
34 points, but they got 38.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah, so it was probably a great match, and Fiji just were on fire, and they played South Africa in the quarterfinals, and nearly beat South Africa. So they were clearly a pretty talented, good side. But
why was it your last game for Wales, do you think?
Because he didn't pick me again. I was really disappointed. Not disappointed, obviously disappointed. It's horrible for your Welsh career to finish, and when you've had that as part of your life, you want to keep going, and you really miss it. But I think after that tournament, Warren Gatland came in, and he didn't select me, which is fair enough. So I remember I spoke to him before the 2007 Six Nations. Said, "Oh, you're going to miss out this time. We've chosen Andy." No, it wasn't Andy Power. You just said you're just going to miss out. We're not going to pick you. And I was gutted because I felt at that time as well, I'd worked really hard, and by being dropped, it had improved me as a player. And I'd gone away and reflected on it. I'd become a more all-round player. And I played that season. I felt I played some great rugby for the Dragons. And I think I could have thrived at international level under Warren Gatland with the type of coach he is, because he just wants like work rate and it's people who got good basic skills, and I think I had some of those attributes, and I think I could have thrived under him in terms of the other stuff that he would have demanded of me as a player as well. So it was a disappointment not to play, but that's the way it goes, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, after that you carry on playing, you go from the Dragons to Saracens. Nice to enjoy a different atmosphere of English rugby. But then a series of really terrible injuries mean that your career comes to a stuttering end towards the end of the decade, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It was really horrible for me. So I went to Saracens.
Knee injuries, I think it is.
So I went to Saracens full of ambition, and I signed for Eddie Jones, who's obviously a world-renowned top coach and obviously pretty...
pretty famous now, as of today.
He's obviously a top...
I should make the point we're making there, because people were listening back for years on this programme. We actually recorded this programme on the day that Eddie Jones was announced as the New England coach.
But he signed me and I had an absolutely fantastic time. Moving to Saracens in many ways was one of the best decisions of my life, for me and my wife and my family. An absolutely amazing time in St. Albans, and my kids grew up there. We just had a wonderful time, and the whole experience of playing in the Premiership and being at Saracens was really special and a great part of my life. And it was unfortunate that it didn't work out. They had two knee reconstructions, so back-to-back. I didn't recover from the first one. And then when I got released by Saracens then because of the clause. If you have a clause in your contract, if you're injured for like more than 6 months, you can be released. And that's what happened with the new coaches coming in, Brendan Venter. And then I tried to find other clubs and failed medicals there. So I was left with a decision to retire. But I think if someone had said to me when I started out, this is the career you'll have, but you'll have to finish a little bit earlier, I would have bitten their hand off.
Michael, one of the stories that's emerged from that Welsh team of, say, 10 years ago, and he did indeed, he was brilliant here on MySport.live, is that Gareth Thomas, 100 caps for Wales, one of the most impressive athletes I think I've ever met in terms of size and all the rest of it. He tells the story, and of course he's on TV adverts now telling the story of how he had to tell his teammates that he was gay. It's such an unusual thing in top-class sport, ridiculously, but there it is. Can you remember if you knew in the team?
I think I can remember everything sort of breaking out. It was around the time of the 2007 World Cup, maybe a little bit before that. So I can remember all that sort of coming out and saying, and that stuff being in the press and being speculated upon. Yeah, and I think it was a really tough time for Gareth. As you say, he's obviously he's an impressive athlete and stuff. He's a big man. And I remember him, he came to a camp and he just looked really gaunt and really thin and everything. Obviously, stress and things affecting him. But then I think from a playing point of view, I don't think it didn't make any difference whatsoever. I've just treated him because he was the life and soul of the team as well. If you like, he'd always be the one on the bus you'd hear messing about, having a laugh and whatever. And he was a great captain for Wales. And he was also, when I started playing for Wales, so we like you said earlier, we weren't very good. We were struggling. So 2002, 2003, and sort of him and Colin Chavis were really sort of set an example not in terms of off the field maybe, but in terms of the way they performed on the field. They were like real warriors on the rugby field, and they'd like battle hard, and every time they played they were just really impressive and really sort of showing you what you've got to do if you want to try and be a top international and have a good career. And he was certainly a great example for myself and other people as young players.
You got him on Strictly Come Dancing or whatever it was he did.
I didn't see any of that, but I think I'm sure he was good now as well. But he's a really nice fella and really warm and generous.
I thought he was remarkable.
And a great personality. And he's obviously doing some really important stuff now and breaking down prejudices and
absolutely.
Stuff. And
absolutely.
And of course, to be commended.
And of course, you know, because soccer, football, still has no openly gay players at the top level. People think it's going to be this huge thing, and people. But what happened with Gareth shows that, you know, mostly people said, "Oh, good for you! Now get on with the game." And he was applauded on and off the pitch. And I know he was a great player, and therefore he had the backing of the public. But I do think, and of course, when he talks about it, he had to pluck up such incredible courage. And for a man who is so brave, anyway, with the way he plays. It was amazing, but I do think we've got to get past all this and just say, look, people are what they are. If it's not harming anybody else, let's move on.
It doesn't make any difference. There's a dress room environment as well. Like, and I think it in time it'd probably become a joke sort of scenario and stuff. And because he's comfortable with the people he's with and he's enjoying their company, it doesn't change. It's just another facet of your life, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, that was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. The other thing is, Michael, because you are so recently in the game, I want to talk to you about the way the game is today. And we are recording this all in the immediate aftermath of the Rugby World Cup and New Zealand's triumph. I know that you thought the standard of rugby was extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought the World Cup as a whole, the way it was organised, the way the stadiums were full, the way the second-tier nations, if you like, performed, the shock of Japan beating South Africa, which is like one of the most incredible sport in shocks of all time.
Gets
I think
the old Fiji thing offered at Outer Pink Mines.
And then New Zealand, probably one of the greatest rugby teams of all time, winning the tournament and the signing off for five or six like truly great players. So yeah, it was just an unbelievable tournament, and someone like Argentina as well coming in and showing such quality. It was just a fantastic tournament and a fantastic advert for rugby. And I think one of the things that was really important was the values and everything that were on show as well. I think like there were some great moments of sportsmanship and great moments of fun, and it was just a wonderful tournament.
When you were hurt in 2009, I found, and this is relevant, I found when I was doing research for this programme, a piece in The Guardian by Paul Rees saying that your injury was bringing to the end a career which had, in its own way, been allowed to fall away slightly by changes in the game. And his argument was that players like yourself, a big man but very skilled, we heard the commentary on Kevin's try, Kevin Morgan's try, where he says, the number eight has great hands. Of course, that was you in the commentary. Has been replaced, at this time at least, in the writer's mind, by an obsession with size and power, replacing skill. I don't know what you feel about that, but I do know that in this World Cup, particularly New Zealand, no matter how big and tough you are, if you can't handle the ball, you won't get in their team, will you? And that's the difference between them and the Northern Hemisphere teams.
Yeah, in some sense, yeah.
You can still be a bullock in the Northern Hemisphere teams and not necessarily a skilled player with the ball. You wouldn't get into New Zealand's team like that.
Yeah, definitely, because they've got more choice of players and they play in a different way and stuff. But New Zealand are pretty remarkable. But I certainly think that like when you look at the standard of rugby in the World Cup as well, it was tremendous and it was really entertaining as well. I think there are a lot of people who maybe rugby's not like the sports fans, they just watch a bit of it, but they would have watched that rugby and they would have been absolutely enthralled and they would have thought, wow, what a sport this is. It's fantastic because of the multi-dimensions of it and the collisions and stuff. So I think that when you go from watching the World Cup and then you put on like a Premiership match, an English Premiership match,
and you watch Gloucester and Bath hiding the ball in a ruck for 20 minutes, it's a different spectator experience.
It's a different, much different spectator experience. And I think sometimes, I don't know whether because there's so many games, because there's like 22 games over the course of a long period of time, I don't know whether that's maybe like too many games, and it does become very difficult as a player because the attrition and the physicality takes its toll, and you're maybe not able to perform at your best. And like in the World Cup, it was like those games were like flat out everything on the line. And when you're playing in the Premiership, maybe it's a bit more of a slog and a grind and you've got to sort of get through the season.
And yet, you know, and I'm one of the exact people you're talking about, somebody who likes the game at a very high level, but is not steeped in rugby. Yeah. And yet the things you remember, you don't remember the brilliant forward battles. And I understand that's where it all goes on. You don't remember the people who are getting to the breakdown first. You remember the ball going through hands, lightning fast running, and somebody crashing over the line.
Yeah,
and even that Welsh team that preceded you by a quarter of a century, which people still talk about, we course the Pontypool front row, and of course the grand Mervyn Davis and the great forwards they had. But what people remember is Barry John and Phil Bennett and Gareth Edwards and JPR Williams getting the ball and playing with it. I mean, that is what sticks in people's minds.
Yeah, it's the iconic moments, isn't it? When you see people, a great team try with it, it's like multiple passes and multiple phases of play. That is what people want to see. And it's like seeing people like Shane Williams, Williams, Jason Robinson, watching those players playing against them, playing with them. It's that's what sort of excites you and makes you.
I would be horrified if the game went to a place, and Jonah Luma's recent death reminds us of, you know, the size of forwards now. Shane Williams is the exact person to pick on. It would be terrible if someone of Shane's size suddenly was excluded from the sport.
Yeah, I think what happens is, though, I think the game changes and people adapt to be able to cope with what the demands of the game are at that time. But someone like Shane Williams was incredibly strong, incredibly powerful, incredibly quick. So I don't think it's necessarily a size thing. It's about your power and your ability. And I certainly think now, with the work that's happening in academies, they are trying to find those players who've got that X factor and just make the best of their athleticism. So I think there's always be a room for players of all shapes and sizes.
I hope you're right, Michael. I really hope you're right. You have a great many years ahead of you, just stepping out in front of you. Tell me where you are now in your life and what you hope for in the future.
Yeah, so when I finished playing rugby, I went back to university and finished my degree. And I got did multiple things, so did some coaching at the Hartford Rugby Club, did some media work and things like that, and then I got my degree with a view to becoming a PE teacher. I went and trained in a school in St Albans called Sandringham. Had a great time there, and then got a job at Haileybury College, which is in Hertfordshire. It's a boarding school, so I'm there as a director of rugby.
I think it's pretty posh to have a director of rugby.
Yeah, they have a director of rugby, and I'm working as a PE teacher as well. And yeah, it's a fantastic job, so I'm getting to put back into the game. We've got a few Saracens Academy kids there as well, so I'm getting to liaise with Saracens and trying to help develop them and help them to become stars of the future, if you like. And yeah, I'm really enjoying it. The school's a fantastic place, great environment to work. My children are attending the school and getting a fantastic education as well, so it's a really a great lifestyle, and I'm really enjoying myself.
And tell me, please, the romantic in me wants to know that Lucy from the French class, she's still on the scene?
Yeah, I mean, Lucy going strong, yeah. So we've got three children. So we got Ellie, who's 13, who's is at Haileybury at the minute and really enjoying herself. And then my daughter, Olivia, and Sunny are at the local primary school called Morgan School in Hartford, which is a great school. Yeah, and they're having a great time, and life's pretty good.
Exactly, but the issue with meeting someone at 14 in the French class is if you fall in love, then it's a hell of a long highway to 84, isn't
it? Yeah, we're going all right. We got a good, great relationship, and having, and we've been fortunate as well through rugby. We've done had some amazing experiences, and it feels like we're still in a bit of an adventure. We feel like tourists. We're so close to London, so we're able to pop into London and do all the things like that. So we still feel like we're on holiday a little bit. So it's good fun.
You've been listening to an archive edition of Talk Sport's My Sporting Life with Danny Kelly. Thanks for listening, and make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, and Spotify for more top Talk Sport content.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.